And we established the office of James so far from Acts 12, 17, Acts 15, 19, and 20. Acts 21, verse 18, when Paul went in with us unto James and to all the elders that were present. Acts 21, 19. We said that when you say church, ecclesia, ecclesia must have elders. That's what makes it an ecclesia. James obviously had oversight on the ecclesia, no doubt. And we saw, you know, the emergence of that and the responsibility he had and why he had to write to the churches in diaspora. Now, we're now basically in chapter 5 and the very first verse. But before that, I want us to stir up our minds a bit and see, you know, we've been talking about how we should read in verses and not in paragraphs. That a paragraph usually will have a concept. It's a continuation of a whole story, but it's like to break down a story in different concepts. And you must learn to know when a new concept emerges. Okay? Let's view this a bit. Now, look at that James 1. Having introduced himself in the first verse, which is usually like an introduction. When you write a letter, you put your name and who you are, and that's exactly what he has done. Then you talk about the addressee. Who are you talking to? My brethren. So, that by the addressee, you will know from maybe historically, who are these people? So you don't miss it. When you look at Hebrews 1:1, look at the opening statement. God, who has sundry times in diverse manner, spoken time past to our fathers. That terminology shows you that that letter had a Jewish audience. Again here, the introduction shows the people he's writing to. Now he says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. So the opening paragraph is about temptations. And even though the words may have been the same that he used later on, but it's temptation. So by the time you get to verse 5, it's still the same thing. Why? If any of you lack wisdom, when? During tests and trials. Let him ask of God. Now, what can happen to a man in tests and trials when he doesn't have insight? He lets us know. He becomes a double-minded man that is unstable in all his ways. By technical reading, verse 8 truncates a paragraph. But verse 9, let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted. He's not talking temptation again. At this point, he's talking about earthly situations where a man is humbled. Okay? Then he drives it home till verse 11, where he talks about the natural status of men. By verse 12, he now talks about temptation and says, you receive a crown of life when you endure. Obviously, the temptation he's talking about here is still the same temptation he had mentioned in verse 2. Because if it's the temptation of verse 13 to 15, you are not supposed to endure that. Same words, but the concept has changed. So because he's talking generally about Christian conduct, the words he'll be using will be words that deal with investigating something, proving something, and so on and so forth. So a different concept comes in here. He says, when you are tempted, then he says, this temptation is a function of desire. So, subparagraph. Then, He now introduces what we can call two kinds of men. Then in verse 17, he says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, from the Father of light, who is the necessary authority. So again, he introduces the new birth. Notice that concepts are changing. And he's talking to the believer. He starts by talking about tests and trials. Then he goes into the believer's conduct. He mentions, from verse 22, 23, 24, doing the word. Now, in Paul's instance, his writings make it clearer. Now concerning this, as I wrote to you afore. So he, James doesn't use this kind of style. And do you know who spoke like this? Jesus. Jesus is the person someone came to and said, thou art a teacher come from God, for no man doeth these miracles except you are with him. He said, except a man is born again. Look at this. He cannot see. He cannot enter. Then as he talks about the mode of communication, he now talks about redemption. So he is explaining how the new birth comes to be from verse 12 or 13, really, 14. Then he talks about his resurrection. Then, by verse 16, 17, 18, the consequence of not believing, the story changes. Then you hear about John the Baptist. Then John the Baptist also talks about eternal life. So John the Beloved puts those things together where he links, because you never heard John preaching after Jesus about eternal life until John the Beloved. So what John the Beloved has done is to bring in something John said about Jesus, which must have been earlier. He brings it to buttress something Jesus said afterwards. So it's another style of writing where you bring similar facts together. That John said this, Jesus said, even though they didn't say it at the same time, then they put it together. So you must know when concepts change. Just like James. So in reading his letters, you see, he changes the concepts. The concept of temptation initially was when you are tried, what we can call persecution. Then he moves to the concept of test being the test of your desires. Even though the words are the same, and even contextually, you can almost say, these are the same content. No, the concept changed. So, in reading, you learn to paragraph. You paragraph and say, this is this. Look at Paul. And of course, the translators did their best in putting those paragraphs in what we can call chapters. And they tried, but it's not all the time that they got it right. Is it very clear? So, how do I identify a paragraph? I look at the concept. If you see 1 Corinthians 6, verse, I would have broken it in verse 20. After talking about judgment, okay? Notice 1 Corinthians 5, Paul, he talks about that brother. In fact, if you start from 1 Corinthians 4 to 5 to 6, is about judgment. Judging ministers, 1 Corinthians 4. 5, judging brethren in the congregation. Judgment still, but concept has changed. 6, brethren judging themselves and taking things before unbelievers. Then he says, look, such were some of you. You are not like the unbeliever. It changes the concept. I would have shifted from verse 10. And then I would have had chapter 7 from verse 10 of 1 Corinthians 6, where he now talks about who is the believer, who is the non-believer, we are washed. Then he now talks about sexual relationships. That is what led to chapter 7. So I would have broken it there. I would have broken chapter 7 the way he did, because he was talking about a man being one flesh with a woman in 6:18, which led to, therefore, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, you wrote to me. So obviously, he was answering that question earlier in chapter 6. Who's following what I'm saying here? So by the time we get to chapter 7, so they got that right to chapter 7 to 39 and 40, where he says, look, be happy, marry somebody in the Lord. So that was cool. But by chapter 8, when now began to speak about, you know, food offer to idols and knowledge and all that, that looks ideal to break that at that point. So the concept changed from marriage to concerning. In fact, he said that concerning. So concerning helps you in Paul's letters. Perai. That is, I'm changing what I'm saying now. But other writers didn't write that way. Are you getting this? So you must know how to break it into paragraphs. So when you read like that, you will not mix issues up. In 1 Corinthians 14, I mean, the writers got it well. When they stopped at, let us do this and the other. 1 Corinthians 14:40. They now says, now the gospel. Clear distinction. By even that 15, by the time you pick it, you will know that what is it discussing? The glorified body. Because the issue was with 15 was 12. Some say that there is no resurrection. That was the reason why it began from 15. If somebody was telling me that by reading that 15 verse 1, that says, wherein you believe, if you continue, except you have believed in vain, that looks somehow. Why would Paul say you are, if you stand, except you have believed in vain? Is he saying if you don't stand, you have not believed? I say, you are reading in verses. The same guy now mentioned the vain in 14, in 17, and in 58. The vain he's saying is this: if only in this life you have hope in the gospel, then you are, that is, if the resurrection from the dead, you don't believe it. You do not believe that when a man dies, that he will be raised from the dead physically. Then, if you don't believe what we have preached unto you, then you have believed in vain. Do you understand this at all? So you don't pick the vein of verse 2 and start shaking. Does he mean I'm not eternally saved? That's not what he's talking about. Trace that paragraph carefully and see discussion. By the time he finishes that, look, be steadfast, be immovable, always abound in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain. That means it is not for this life. Is that very clear? Chapter 16:1, he changes the subject. Now, concerning the collection for the saints. So you see, Paul's letters are read. You can read it easily. But you see, all these James and Peter, they are difficult. they didn't introduce those, as it were, academic kind of writing. So you must learn to read in paragraphs so that you will not mix issues up. Hope this is helping you. Learn to read that way. I think I'll deal with that later as we deal with some of these letters. So James is like that. So James 4. Yesterday we saw where he said, therefore to him that knows to do good and doeth it not, to him is a sin. Go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your mysteries that shall come upon you. Now this is a bit of it's because, you know, in verse 13 he had talked about those who go to purchase. We said yesterday to make merchandise. We said that yesterday to acquire, kadaino, to acquire, to make merchandise. The word emporomai, we saw that yesterday. Now he now says, go to you rich men, weep and howl for your mysteries that shall come upon you. Now he cannot say this cannot be an absolute statement to all rich men. No. Because just like Jesus, you know, when people try to pick Jesus' words carelessly, you have to be very careful in your hermeneutic of Jesus' words. If you have two clothes, give it to one person. And did you see Jesus practice that? If somebody doesn't ask you, give him. If somebody asks you for one mile, give him two. He didn't practice that. Literally that way. So your hermeneutic should be able to look at what was he saying. It's a figurative way of talking about generosity. Are you getting this at all? So you must be careful how you read those words. When a word is a figure of speech and is parallel, you must be careful. Oh, it's better to enter the kingdom without a hand. Do you get it? And then you say, let me cut my hand. You know? That's an hyperbole. Hyperbole, sorry. So you must know how those words are used. You know, come enter the eye of a needle. So they know the eye of a needle is the temple gate. There's nothing like that in the temple. He spoke like that, figuratively and literally. That, look, the way a camel, you have to squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it. So, he's just telling you, don't have trust in riches. That's all. So, when you're not trying to bring it into a literal term, you begin to teach all kind of heresy. So, the same thing here. James is saying this. Go to now, you rich men. Weep how, for your ministers have come upon you. It will be wrong to take his words out of context. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Of course, these are figurative expressions. Your gold and silver is cankered, and your rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. You have heaped treasures together for the last days. Now, what is he referring to? So that we don't get it wrong. In verse 4, I would like to take it from 6. 6 says, you have condemned and killed the just, and it doth not resist you. So the rich people he's talking to, is it clear to you now? Huh? Okay. Oppressors. Of course, the setting in those days has a lot to do with rich people who were oppressive. So he says, you have put to death, you have murdered the just that doth not resist you. Of course, the murder there is again figurative. It doesn't mean necessarily to put to kill. It means to show hatred and contempt for, which he had used earlier in James 2:11 and James 4:2. Then he says, the just. Just here is somebody who hasn't done wrong. Then he says in verse 6, you are condemned. Now, the word condemned there is the word katadikazo. K-A-T-A-D-I-K-A-Z-O. D-I-K-A-Z-O. It means to declare and condemn, maybe to death or to punishment. He says, you have done this to the just, and he does not resist you. So, that is what antitasso. He does not resist you. He hasn't stopped you. So, obviously, the rich he was talking to from verse 1 are oppressive people. Oppressive. And look at verse 3 again. It says, your gold and silver is cankered. The rest of them shall be a witness against you. You have eaten your flesh as well fire. You have heaped up treasure together for the last day. So, no doubt, he's talking about the word pleasure. There is the word trumphao, T-R-U-M-P-H-A-O, luxury. He's talking about those who live in luxury. And yet, the means of their gain is oppressive. Now, there's a challenge here. Is he talking to believers? I have a slight challenge with what he's saying, because it appears like he is talking about rich. He's like talking about the fate of oppressive rich men generally, and putting the believer to caution, because a believer can. He has already said to us in chapter 2 that we don't make distinctions. So where we now find a believer that is rich and an oppressive one, is now generalizing for you that this is the fate of those who are oppressive and they are rich. So, James 5, he uses the word again, you have heaped up together, you have eaten your flesh as it were fire, and then he says, you have heaped up treasures. He uses again another word, which is the word patalao. S-P-A-T-A-L-A-O. Wastefulness. Wastefulness. That without oppression, you now throw a party. Your child wants to get married. He does his reception on the moon. He comes back and does wedding in water. He says, despite the fact that you're oppressing people, you are now living in luxury. I dare say that this is Solomon. I believe that he picked from Solomon's conduct. You know, it was Solomon that declared everything he had as vanity. And it is the same thing that James is saying here. Because it was Solomon that oppressed people and became wealthy. So, I dare say that, yes, he's talking to rich men generally, which includes the righteous and the unrighteous, but he's putting the believer, who is wealthy, is putting him to caution. And so, look at this. So, he says, behold, verse 4 is key here. He says, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields. He said, the hire. You have employed people. Who have reaped down your fields, which you have kept back by fraud. The word kept back by fraud is the word apostereo. A-P-O-S-T-R-E-O. It means you deprive them. And this is people that pay low salaries and old salaries and use people to acquire wealth, and this is what they call wisdom to make money. That you are using people's wealth, their efforts and all that, and then you underpay them. And they are not any good after working and slaving for you. So this is the word apostereo. You find that word in Mark 10:19, 1 Corinthians 6, 7, and 8. 1 Corinthians 7 verse 5 and 1 Timothy 6, 5. Mark 10:19, 1 Corinthians 6, 7 and 8. 1 Corinthians 7, 5. 1 Timothy 6, 5. You deprive people. So, this deals with oppressors. Then he says, in verse 5, you have lived in pleasure on the earth. Oh, this is why I missed it. I'm sorry for that. I missed that. You have lived in pleasure on the earth. Okay? And I've been wanton. Is that word wanton that I wanted to, that I called Elias Patalao? Wastefulness on the earth. You have nourished in your heart as in the day of slaughter. The word is twilight, wastefulness. That you have nourished in your heart like you are just wasting things. You are living large, buying expensive things, and yet those who are working for it, you deprive them. That's what he's dealing with. And he says, look, in verse 4, the cries of them which have breathed are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts in the Greek. The armies, Lord of the armies, saying to you that the entire wealth you have heaped together becomes nothing at the end of the day. And he places a very strong call, you know, on this. Look at James 2:6. But you have despised the poor. Are you following? You have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you. The word despise is the word atimazo. A-T-I-M-A-Z-O. To dishonor. You have dishonored the poor. You have brought shame. Do not the rich oppress you. And he says, watch this. In fact, that word oppress is a continuous word. Do they not keep oppressing? The Greek word is the same word used in Acts 10:38. All that we oppress of the devil. Is the Greek word kata dunestio. K-A-T-A-D-U-N-E-S-T-E-U-O. Just like demonic oppression. So James is very clear on this. He's talking to those who are oppressive. You know, we can call it wisdom today. that the guy is just smart. You know, and James says there is judgment on such means of wealth. And you know, Jesus said the same thing. You know, we said that James is the closest to the words of Jesus because it's the first letter. So he gleaned a whole lot from the Sermon on the Mount and many things that Jesus said. This is making sense? All right. Go back to James 5. So he says, you have lived in pleasure. That's James. You have lived in pleasure on the earth and in wanton. You have nourished your heart as in the day of slaughter. He says, you have condemned and killed the just that does not resist you. So, it's about wealth, really. It's about how a man sees wealth. You know, a way, you know, and he uses a lot of images, you know, that, so what is he saying? I think I need to look at one word. Verse 5. They are all images. You have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. You have nourished your heart. In fact, the real Greek word there is you have fattened yourself for the day of slaughter. And this one is used oftentimes for cattle. You know, when you want to eat very well for a cattle, you feed the chicken very well. So that eventually you can. So he's saying you are just like that fattened cow that eventually will be destroyed, referring to the wealth. So obviously he's dealing with those who are using the economic status of others to oppress them, and that is very key here. I must also make an observation. And look at Luke 12. Let's see something in Luke 12. Luke 12 is an example of something we are reading here. A man who was rich, Jesus said in verse 21, not towards God. And what he deals with, what Jesus deals with in this rich guy, is not the wealth as much as his arrogance. The arrogance of it. The arrogance of it. You know, the same thing that Solomon will call the wealth of the wicked. He says he laid up for the just. That's what he said. The wealth of the wicked. You know, talking about those who acquire wealth by wicked means. Eventually, they don't have control over it when they are gone. Just talking about the futility of wealth. So, Jesus, in addressing this rich fool, addresses the same thing. Now look, the guy just says, well, I have no lack. I don't have anything. He said, the arrogance of wealth is what he addresses here. That a man's, verse 15, a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. I must make a silent observation that in the words of Jesus, and this is something you can think about, when he mentions poor, it appears like it had two connotations. There was poor economic status, you know, and Jesus was a friend to the poor. And there was also the poor he used for spiritual status. Now, somehow, Luke in Luke 6:20 talked about the poor from an economic point of view. But Matthew 5:3 says poor in the spirit. Now there are ways you look at that. That means that Jesus addressed those two, both a poor man economically and a poor man spiritually. And he actually came to show succor and not bring shame to any. Are you there? Are you following this? So, when a poor, for example, says that being poor, as poor, yet making many rich, 2 Corinthians 6:10, and in your head, I remember somebody said that, look at that scripture, making many rich. I said, what about the word as poor? And the man was driving the best cars And he says, as poor. Are you poor? Of course, it's figurative. As poor there means when Paul says as poor, he ain't making many rich. That look, we are looking oppressed with the apostles. We are the scoffer of the world. We are poor. That is, we are lowly. Yet, making many what? Abundant. Both instances is not referring to physical wealth. As poor. That is figurative. We are looking lowly, yet we are making people abundant spiritually, despite the fact that we are looking poor. Is that very clear? Not that we are poor spiritually, we are making many rich materially. That's your mindset. So, there definitely was, look at Proverbs 28 verse 6. There definitely was a narrative in the teachings of Jesus that James also took from. And that's why you and I, we must be very strong against anyone seeing the poor in a shameful state. Proverbs 28 verse 6. Blessed is the poor that walks in his uprightness, than he that is perverse in his ways, though he be rich. You can see that Jesus thought like this, and definitely James. Now when you see a poor man who is righteous, he is blessed. Yet the rich man who is perverse in his ways is not blessed. But you know, in our materialistic sense, it's the guy that is rich that is blessed. So Jesus taught in this regard, and same way James. Go back to James 5. Hope you are learning something here. For you have condemned the innocent. And that is where rich people use the justice system to even oppress the poor. And so he's dealing with the social economic status and then telling the believers, you cannot be like that. And you see, many of the things he said here, you can see it in Psalm 37. I'll start from verse 9, the evildoers. Let's just take a few ones. Verse 11. For the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight himself in the abundance of the peace. See, Jesus also said this in the Sermon on the Mount. The wicked plotted against the just and gnashes him with his teeth. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn out the sword, have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy. So can you see, that's where James got this from. Can you see it? To slay such as be as upright conversation. That is, they condemn them to justice. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bow shall be broken. It is that a righteous man's heart is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord opposes the righteous. The Lord knoweth the days of the upright, and in heaven shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed their evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. But the wicked shall perish, and the armies of the Lord be as the fat of lambs. They shall come. So you can see that this is where James got it from. They are as a fatting. As fat of lambs they shall consume, unto smoke shall they consume away. The wicked borrows and pays not again, but the righteous shows mercy and gives. For such as is. So when you say the wicked borrow, that might be what borrow meant to take from. It is not to owe money now, and doesn't pay again. Referring to what he said earlier, that they deprive them of their due wages. But the righteous shows mercy and gives. Such as he be blessed, they shall inherit the earth, and it shall be cursed of him that shall be cursed of him. I mean, can go on and on and on. So that's where James got the narrative from. So obviously, just like the word of the Old Testament, a figurative expression, James now brings them and says them the same way. That you see, these are heaped up to the day of judgment. So it's important to realize that he, just like Jesus, James 5, he's dealing with oppression. I've said earlier that we do not distinguish which rich and poor, and we do not permit people to use wealth as a means of boasting or causing injustice. Are you there? So, can we therefore say, can we classify James 5, 1 to 6 as a paragraph on its own, or do we lump it to chapter 4, verse 17? He that knows to do good and does not do it, to him is a sin. Can we start James 5, 1 from 4, 17? Look at it. Because that 17 is not related to the boasting of 16. Can you see it? Who's following what I'm saying? You know it's not related. Because 4:16 says, now you rejoice in your boastings, and all rejoicing is evil. Therefore, to him that knows that which is good and does not do which is good, go to now, you rich men. It appears like that was a different concept. Of course, it's still around boasting over wealth. But it's like a different subject came out from that 17 to verse chapter 5, verse 1. Are you getting what I'm talking about? It, you know, and he's now explaining the boasting of these rich men, and he says their boasting is out of oppression. Though he introduces a different concept from chapter 4, 17 to chapter 5, verse 1. Is this making sense now?
Right.
So the rich is referring to there, so don't feel funny. Just like Jesus says that it is hard for a rich man to enter into the kingdom. When he said that relative to the man he just spoke to. Not every rich man. Is that very clear? That rich man, the guy, he said, he that trusts in riches. And that goes into all the epistles. Let them not trust in uncertain riches. James 5. So, can we end chapter 4, 17 in chapter 5, 6? Because the next thing he says in 5, 7 is, be patient therefore, brethren. Is that a new subject?
Very good.
Be patient, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, he says, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth, and had long patience for it until he received the early and latter rain. Now, I know this has become rhema, that there's the early rain. Early rain is Acts 2. Latter rain is the last revival. Brethren, is a figure of speech. He says, be patient for just like that. He's asking you to be patient. He's teaching patience, not move of the spirit. The rain there, James does not imply that you use rain there for the same. Is that the days of the latter rain? The anointing. James will be shocked at our use of this verse. Let us see what he's talking about. Be patient. Okay? Then he says, because the husbandman waits and has long patience. So, the word be patient there is the word, just wait for this, is the word makrothymio. M-A-K-R-O. T-H-Y-M-E-O. M-A-K-R-O-T-H-Y-M-E-O. It means to wait. To wait. Then he says the husbandman, that's a farmer. So he now says, just wait the way a farmer waits. That a farmer will wait. There will be a first rain. Then there will be a latter rain. Latter rain simply means the one after the first one. It's not latter move of the spirit. He will wait. Be ye therefore also patient. So the husbandman there, is that husbandman God? So is that latter rain there literal? Yes. Is the former rain there literal? Yes. That learn from the farmers who plant and then wait. Is that clear? For the precious fruit of the earth, and had long patience for it until he receives the early and the latter rain. Because that is, I mean, their usual projections when you go and plant. So it says in verse 8, be ye also, just like the husbandman, just like a farmer, be patient, establish your heart, for the coming of the Lord draws near. Establish your heart, for the coming of the Lord draws near. I know we have, for liberty's sake, use this verse for evangelism. You know, and I think it's good to evangelize. But what he's saying here is just teaching you patience from a parable point of view. You know the way Jesus will be talking, then he introduces a parable. That's what he has done here. So the husbandman is not God. So you therefore be patient. It says, establish your heart, for the coming of the Lord draws near. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge stands before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and patience. So, what is he dealing with there? Persecution for the gospel. Is it very clear now? So learn from the prophets their example. Again, he uses the word here in verse 10, macrothemia. Say, take, my brethren, just watch how they were patient. That is, suffering, affliction, alright, and of patience. So that means the context of the patience from verse 7 is what? Trials. Remember, that's how we started. The trial of your faith works what? Patience. So it says the same way that a farmer, you know, has patience for the early and the latter rain. Have patience for the coming of the Lord. That's what he's teaching. That's what he's teaching. He's teaching affliction, persecution, and trials. So if you do not understand the concept, you know that he is going gradually to how he started the letter. Are you following this? Where you now lack wisdom, you ask of God. Is that very clear? So in verse 11, he now says, behold, we count them happy which endure. That word there is perseverance. It's the word hypomeno, to stay under. Hypomeno, H-Y-P-O, which endure, which persevere. Persevere what now? Persevere under what case? Under what? Trial of your faith. What were the prophets is talking about? What did they suffer? Did they suffer economic crisis? That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about afflictions. Just like Jesus said that they were killed for my sake. So learn from their patience. So the context here is persecution. Now let me say this quickly. A whole lot of the setting of almost all the epistles had persecution there. Philippians, a good number in Ephesians, definitely. First and Second Thessalonians, Hebrews. There was a lot of persecution against believers. Hebrews, obviously First Peter and Second Peter, and without doubt too, the book of Revelation. A whole lot. Some had false doctrine. You know, Colossians had a lot of knowledge, false doctrine, a whole lot. Some parts of Titus as well. And then you had the 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. But when you see even Romans, where he says, see, if we reign with him, no, that's not it. that we will suffer together with him. We shall be glorified together with him. Of course, persecution is in view there. A man being tried for his faith. So when I read Philippians, I say, rejoice, rejoice. And you're using your own for a lot. Rejoice again, I say rejoice. In the midst of it, he said, don't be careful for anything. He's talking in the, because he had opened the letter by saying, pray for me that, you know, it will be to, you are praying for him, that will be to me for my salvation. And the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. It's not just giving on behalf of Jesus to believe on him, but to also suffer. When he now gets to, he talks about humility, and talks about just an example, then he now says, look, that is why, whether I'm absent or present, I'm here of your affairs. Then he now says, look, work out your own salvation with trembling and fear. It's God who is at work here. It was in view of persecution. He said, therefore, you will not murmur or grumble. Do all things without murmuring, that you will be blameless sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. So if you don't understand the setting of what he's saying, you will just take that scripture. Okay, there will be sons of God without rebuke, that you will shine as light. Oh, in my organization, I will shine as light, oh God. What he's talking about there is in the midst of persecution. So some of those times we don't even understand. We say rejoice. And he says, look, whatever things are pure, think on these things. I mean, it's bringing the mind of the believer to rest in spite of what he. That's why when you pray in that persecution, it doesn't flow with you. Why? He says, the peace of God will guard your heart. I say, I need land, say the peace of God. How is the peace of God? The answer to my Philippians, my own Philippians 4:6 is husband or wife. But Paul was talking about persecution. That's why this peace of God, that personal understanding will guard your heart. Because it was related to the gospel. Standing fast together for the faith of the gospel. Are you following what we are saying here? That is the context of what he was saying. Of course, in the middle of it, you have the issue of false teachers and all that. So, James's letter is understood well when you know that these believers in diaspora were suffering for the faith. So, they were words of assurance. Words of warning not to go in the flesh. And words of assurance to be patient. Is this making sense? Is this making sense? Alright, now look at this. Verse 11. We count them happy which persevere. You have heard of the patience of Job. The patience of Job. And I've seen the hand of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. See how he picks his word about Job, that he was patient. Job was you can call Job everything. Ignorant, presumptuous, and all that. But you can see a man that never cast off his faith in his ignorance. So you can learn from that. Look at his patience. The Lord was merciful. The Lord didn't bring it upon him. He has said that, look, James 1:13-15, James has told you that trial and affliction did not come from God. Neither does sin come from God. But count it all joy when you fall or you come against diverse tests and trials. So now I want us to observe this word, patience. It has a compound word that I want us to look at. Because in James verse 11, where he mentions endure, then he mentions patience. He uses two words that we can learn from. Now, the word patience there is the word makotima, which is similar to what we said earlier. M-A-K-R-O-T-Y-M-A. It is used, please listen to this. In this instance, in 1 Corinthians 13:4. First Corinthians 13 verse 4. And it seems like Paul uses it side by side. Love suffers long, is kind. Okay? Envy is not. Now, the word suffers long there is used for delayed anger. Delayed anger. Then in verse 7, he now says, endures all things. That is to persevere. So the first one, which is where you have the word patience. Okay? It is to delay anger. The other one is to endure something. So we can say that the first one will deal with relationships. The second will deal with things, experiences, to remain under something. That's the word hypomeno. Let's see another place where he used it. 2 Corinthians 6:4. But in all things, approving ourselves as ministers of God in much patience. Okay? Much patience. That's verse 4. That's the word makrotima. Then he says in verse 6, pureness by knowledge, by long suffering. Again, he changes the word. This is hypomeno. To stay under something and endure it. Look at 2 Timothy 3:10. So one means don't get angry. The other means stay under it. 2 Timothy 3:10. Thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long suffering, charity, and patience. One, again, means when you have long suffering is I endure something. Alright, when you have endurance, or you call it, to bear up. Then when you say patience, in this instance, I think I was too fast the other time. Patience means I am delaying anger. So, it uses both in persecution. In an instance, I'll delay anger. And in the same breath, I now endure what is being done to me. I delay anger in the sense that I'm not responding back. At the same time, I endure what is being done. So one deals with experiences, the other deals with people. I'm not getting angry, yet I remain under the circumstance. So James uses his, go back to James 5, to teach what a believer should learn. He learns to be patient. He also learns to endure. Enduring the instances are patient with men, withholding anger. So in verse 12 he says, above all things, my brethren, James 5:12, above all things, my brethren, swear not. It looks like he's trying to conclude, but I doubt it. Neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, and let your no be no, lest you fall into condemnation. Now, this is a very difficult text, because if you say that, that means if you get to the law court, you should not say, I therefore swear, you know. Again, this is another place where he's taken from what Jesus said. So go to Matthew 5. Matthew 5:34. I'll start from 33. Again, you have heard, Matthew 5:33, that it has been said by them of old, and thou shalt not forswear thyself, but thou shalt perform unto thy Lord thine oath. But I say unto you, okay, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou cannot make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea and yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than this cometh of evil. So, go back to James 5. I would rather change the word swear there to the word oath. Okay? By heaven or earth, lest you fall into condemnation. That is, your use of words here is talking about making a commitment. Now, it's a bit tricky because somehow Jesus slotted that in between love, the issue of love. And so, he said that, look at that, look at something. James, Matthew 5. I skipped that. Matthew 5. He said that in the midst of talking about love, arguably from verse 27, then by verse 30 again you have heard eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You know, in Matthew 5. In James 5, he says this after telling us to delay anger. So there seems to be a similarity, though very tricky, okay, after talking about anger and delaying it, he now says, above all, my brethren, swear not neither by heaven nor by earth, nor by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, and let your no be no, lest you fall into condemnation. Now, what do you think he said that for? Did he say that for the midst of affliction, or he said that in delaying anger? Is he relating this to anger, or just general thinking of oath? What do you think? Because he has said we should delay anger in the midst of affliction and persecution. So what do you think he said the issue of oath for? Above all things. Is that above all things what he has said all through the book, or what he's relating to in the midst of persecution and affliction? Huh? I'm getting you to think now. Huh? What do you think? Does that stand on its own, or is related to your response in affliction and persecution? Why do you make an oath when you have been persecuted? Okay, she says that it's like your commitment not changing when you are persecuted. Who thinks that way? Huh? You think so? Okay, elaborate a bit. So what would the oath be? Yes. Okay. Can we say that the yes, no, be no, again goes back to the unstable man? Huh? Does it relate with the unstable man in all his ways? You know, that man also comes out of persecution. We are studying together now. Does it relate? What's that oath there for? Is the oath related to the persecution? Do we all agree on that? You think so? Why? Your use of words during persecution? Okay, don't make an oath. So don't make a commitment to Jesus. What's it for? Is it of any semblance to Jesus' own word used in Matthew 5? Because Jesus said, don't swear by heaven, don't swear by the earth, don't swear by Jerusalem. Let your yes be yes, don't be no. Anything after that is evil. Evil there again means amiss. Okay? So, what hope? Okay, in Jesus' case again, did he say when you get to court, I say you should come and say, our devil will tell the truth, nothing but the truth, that you should not do it? Why are you all quiet? You think I have the answer? Don't assume. Do you think it is your use of words during persecution or just general? Huh? Talk to me now. You are just smiling. Huh? Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. Will be related to what? Okay. How would my yes be no in persecution? I'm unstable. Is that what he's dealing with? My action is not consistent. Have you been persecuted before? No, I'm not. I'm just asking. My action is not consistent. That I'm under persecution, then I now make an oath. An oath for what? Or can we say that it's a separate comment on his oath? What do you say? Who said something? Why are you not talking? Why are you not talking? Huh? Okay. No, sit down. No, it's the same thing Jesus said. It's let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. That is, let your words be self-affirming. Because that is what Jesus said, that he says anything that is outside yes or no is evil. So we are now saying that, is that related to the persecution or a separate statement on its own? Okay, you think it's double-mindedness. Okay? Accepted. I can flow that to the next step. But is it related to verse 11? So you think the oath is be stable in the midst of persecution and don't make an oath. So my point is, what is the oath for? What is the oath for? When you say, I will not do this, I will do it in the name of God. I therefore call God to witness that I will not do this. That's what it means to make an oath. The point is that, what does that do? What role does that play in persecution? Is there anybody calling you to make an oath in persecution? You get my point. It's a tricky text, because the way it relates to 11 is almost confusing. Now, by saying above all things, maybe he introduced a different concept. Maybe. Do you think so? The next verse, which is 13. I get your point. That the next verse 13 says, if any afflicted, let him pray. So are you saying that rather than make an oath in affliction, I should pray? What is it? Making an oath instead of praying. Praying will be definite. Your yes is yes, your no is no. That's what you think. You agree with them? They are saying that the oath there is the absence of prayer. Am I right? Yeah. That rather than making a commitment in persecution, pray. Yes. Oh, you have something else to say? Yeah. I cannot bear them now. Go on. I thought I heard Smirnoff. Swear not. Oh, sorry. Go on. You can see how Bible definition is. You have to think. You have to think. Go on. You think it's contrasting? Okay. Did Job ever have a temptation to swear, to make an oath? Because, you know, that was an example of somebody he mentioned. Did Job at a point appear double-minded? Okay. So go on. Ah, you are really doing an expounding. But it's fine. It's fine. Because that's how you think. So you are saying that you're saying do not get into the flesh by making undue commitments. Let your strength be drawn. Calm down. You are extending. You have said, you know, strength be drawn. You are talking like a charismatic Pentecostal. So we think it's about who thinks it is a statement on his own. Nobody. Who thinks it's related to verse 11? You will have to pick one. Okay, so you think that in the absence of making it an oath, pray. Who thinks that? Of course, that's what you think. You're the one that said that. So in the absence of, so is the above all then a conclusion of the statements on affliction and patience? It is conclusion of everything from chapter 1. That's too conk. Is he saying both the condemnation Jesus said about an oath and James, is it present or future? Now, I'm stretching your thing. You know, I took you to Matthew 5 for a purpose. Is it present or future? That's the judgment. The judgment of instability in a believer's conduct, is it present tense or in the future? Is what? Present tense. How? You are taking both. You are unstable in all your ways. I'm kidding. But you should have picked one now. You are talking about something and you are now buttressing what you are talking against. It's both future and present. Okay, let's isolate it and come back. Whether we can solve it. So you think that verse 13 is a continuation of 12. That's a bit tricky because somehow prayer started from verse 13 till verse 18. Is that not a different paragraph? Because you can say patience during affliction, paragraph. Not swearing during affliction, different. Praying during affliction, different. Can we divide it like that? Come on, talk. Let's talk. Can we divide it like that? Now, when you are under persecution, be patient. And don't just be patient. Do not make hope. Don't just say, I won't make hope. Pray. But for the purpose of crisis of the concept, we separate them. What about that? Any opinion? Okay, let's try and see whether 13 to 18 can be a paragraph. Is any among you afflicted? It says, let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing psalms. Then it says, is any sick among you? Is that part of persecution? Don't you think that 13 is a different paragraph? He asks questions. Is any sick among you? Is any afflicted? Let him pray. Is any sick among you? Let him pray. Sorry. Let him sing. Sorry. Is anybody? Let him sing some. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church. Okay? Then he says, let them pray over him, anointing with oil in the name of the Lord. Now, when he says sick, the arguments of why we'll look at it. Then he now says, and the prayer of faith shall save the sick, which is the word sozo. Now, the word sick is a tricky term. It's the word asthenio. A-S-T-H-E-N-E-O. It's a tricky term, and I'll tell you why. Please listen carefully. It's used primarily for the sick. No doubt. But by using the word sozo, which has 28 usages for physical distress and 28, that is counsel, for spiritual distress. So, sozo there has been used equally for both spiritual deliverance from harm and a physical deliverance from harm. Look at Hebrews 12, verse 3. Consider him that endures such corruption of sinners against you, lest you be wearied and faint in your mind. Look at that word, weakness in the mind, which is the word asthenio here, sick. So the word can be used for something non-physical. But then many times Jesus said, your faith has saved you. And it was referring to healing. So, I'm saying that because you could encounter people that want to change the narrative here for you. But do not be surprised to hear that the word sick can also be for something spiritual, just like healing, okay? And also, the word save, or save the sick, sozo, can either be spiritual or non-spiritual. So, it's context that will determine it. Now, let's see the context here. It says, let him call the elders. And then it says, let them anoint him. Anoint him with oil. And you know that these are Jews. Anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. Okay? Let them anoint him. Let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. So, we have had pray in verse 13, pray in verse 14, pray in verse 15, and then pray in verse 16, 17, and 18. It will be ridiculous to now focus on anointing oil there. Because what he's teaching there is prayer. So, he now says, anointing him, which is the word aleipho, A-L-E-I-P-H-O. Aleipho. which is used many times for ceremonial application of oil. The word oil there is the word elalon. It's a physical word, E-L-A-L-O-N, used for olive oil, actually. Now, definitely, this word alepho can be used both metaphorically and literally. In the Old Testament, and just like the word creole is used 75 times, you know, for ceremonial usage. Now, quickly look at this. The word alepho is used by Jesus and used literally. John 11:2, John 12:3, Matthew 6:17, anoint your body. That is the way you rub a cream on your body. Mark 6:1. I'll take it again. Matthew 6:17, Mark 6:1, Luke 7:38. Luke 7:46. John 11:2. And John 12:3. The word oil there is also used for a commodity of commerce. Matthew 25:3. Luke 10:6. Matthew 25:3. Luke 10:6. So the word alepho there can be used both ceremonially, which is to actually apply physically, and metaphorically. Where do we have it metaphorically used? Luke 4:18. Acts 4:27. Anoint. Acts 10:38. Hebrews 1:9. And 2 Corinthians 1:21. I think somewhere along the line I missed these words together. I'll sort it out later. I've mixed something up here. But anyway, look at Mark 6:13, which is similar to James 5:14. Mark 6:13. And they cast out many devils and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them. So this definitely is corroborative of James 5:14. Alepho, elalon, and of course, healed those that were sick. It's also used for healing, the word elalon and elepho, in Luke 10:34. Remember the parable of the Samaritan. Luke 10:34. And went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. So it was used for what you can call first aid. It wasn't like the medical expertise, you know. Something like you can say first aid. She said, somebody is weak. He said, yeah, you can, just like I said, you can use medication in the name of the Lord. Now, a bit of this can be criticized because you cannot find an apostle instructing you like you are a medical doctor. You use medication in the name of the Lord. And now, it's not even the person who is sick that is using it, it's the elders. So they now become anointed pharmacists or doctors. So, but then you discover that Paul says to Timothy, said, take no longer water only for your stomach infirmities, but also wine. So it suffices to say that what James was saying there was, look, as you are praying, do not despise natural treatment. James 5:14. Then, you know, he now says, look, let them pray over him, anointing with oil in the name of the Lord, and the prayer of faith. Again, he says prayer a whole lot of times. The prayer of faith, that is the elders now, shall save the sick, obviously for what we have said, his physical sickness, and the Lord shall raise him up. Now, again, this is where we must apply caution. The Lord shall raise him up, and if he had committed sins, they shall be forgiven him. Let's get back to the word prayer of faith. Of course, the prayer of faith from James 1, 5 to verse 8 is where you don't waver. You are not double-minded. They shall save the sick. So, would it not be right to say that, why then say if he has committed any sins, they shall be forgiven him? Is that the continuation of the same concept, or he has introduced something else entirely? Huh? Talk to me. Who thinks it's something else entirely? Okay. Why? Above the next verse. So obviously, he wouldn't be talking about the sick person when he now says, confess your faults one to another. That takes the sale of the sick. He's now talking about relationships in the church. So the verses there were wrong. They should have broken it into two. Is that clear? Because when it says if he has committed sins, let's go into the Greek there. The word if is the word kan. K-A-N. If at the least, the word kan is a conditional word. That if there are sins committed, just like if I touch the hem of his garment, she had not done it. Matthew 5:28. Or 1 Corinthians 13:3. If I have faith to move all mountains, it's like creating a possibility. So it's not dealing with the person that's falling sick, he has committed sin. No. 2 Corinthians 11:16 and also Hebrews 12:20. It deals with something that is not definite. That, if there are sins committed, that we're going to deal with that. If there are sins, the word "e" there, strangely, is not a pronoun. The word "e" there is not a pronoun. It is the word something is existing. Am I? If there exists sins that are committed, so "e" there is not a pronoun. It is the Greek word "emi," E-I-M-I. And the word "committed" is the word to do something. Poio, to create, P-O-I-E-O. So it says, if there are sins that have been done among believers, they shall be forgiven him. Pay attention here. Which is, when I say forgiven him, again, the word "him" there is not for a singular person all the time. It's the word "autos," A-U-T-O-S. To say like, the same shall be forgiven. Or forgiving them. Or forgiving amongst people. Now, the plural version of that will flow by the next statement. Confess your faults one to another. That means it's talking to more than one person. Who's following what we're saying here? So, the pronoun, follow this, please. So, say, and if there are, or if there exists committed sins done, they shall be forgiven amongst us. So, it's talking about a corporate action amongst us. Because the next verse says, confess your faults, which is the word ex homologio. E-X-O-H-O-M-O-L-O-G-E-O. It means to say it out. Say something out. Don't keep it inside. Confess your faults one to another. That is, say it out. Okay? Which is where you have Matthew 3:6. When they came to John the Baptist, it means to acknowledge something openly. That's why it is also used for praise. Matthew 11:25. Luke 10:21. Open praise, public praise. Matthew 11:25. Luke 10:21. Mark 1:5. Where you acknowledge a fault openly. In the book of Acts, you will see it in Acts 19:10. Where they confess their sins. That is, they acknowledge what they were doing openly. Many times, it's not by words, it's by actions. And what did those guys do in Matthew, in Acts 19:10? They burnt what they were doing. So it's like, to acknowledge this is wrong, openly. So he's saying that confess yourself, your faults one to another. Again, you see it in Romans 14:11. An open confession. Open admission. Open acknowledgement. It's also used for praise. The way we praise publicly. Romans 14:11. Romans 15:9. And Philippians 2:11. So it says, if there are any sins in, just like Galatians 6:1. You know, same thing. If there are any sins, okay, he says, they shall be forgiven him. Then he says, confess your faults one to another. The word there is allelon. A-L-L-E-L-O-N. It is a reciprocal pronoun. Me and you. You and I. You and me. So that means he's talking about relationships. So when he says, if there are any sins, is now dealing with relationships. That is, if there are any faults where we have trespassed against one another, if there are any faults, it says we should pray for one another, pay attention, that you may be healed. Now, the healed there is no longer dealing with the sickness of verse 14. Are you following this? It's now human relationships. Remember 1 Peter 2:24. By whose stripe you were healed, you are returned to the bishop of your soul. So it's talking about, you know, the healing or restoration of relationships. So James 5:15. B till 15 till 16 A is talking about what? Talking about what? There's a pray for one another that you may be what? So in the midst of teaching prayer, he's now dealing with restoring relationships. That before we start to pray for one another, we must first of all have what? Restored relationships. So it's teaching prayer, but a subtopic under it is what? Restoring relationships. Who's following this now? That before we have corporate prayer, there must be corporate what? Forgiveness. That is amongst ourselves. So he deals with relationships. So you can see that James's writing can be very tricky. A lot of subtopics. Because the healed there is not of the, and that's why some people can throw it at you if you are into real strong theological debate, that when he says that, is there any sick, that the sick he's referring to there is relationships. But it's not so. Because we found him use the same word for temptation. When you are tested and tried of your faith, he used the same thing for your desires. One done by others, the other done by yourself. Are you following what I'm saying here? So he has a style of writing that he can change the subject. Yet, he uses the same words. Who's following what we're saying here? You know, we said that when we started this series. So, obviously, he first deals with physical sickness. Then he goes to broken down relationships in the congregation. Who's following what I'm saying here? Are you following this? So he says here that we pray, number one, confess your fault one to another. You have done me wrong, I've done you. We openly tell ourselves. Then he now says, we will now pray for one another that you may be healed. That is corporate praying. The effectual fervent prayer, he now says, of a righteous man, maketh or availeth much. Which is the word ischus. I-S-C-H-U-S. Prevailing strength. The word effectual is the word energio. Something that is kept happening. Now, why did he say that? What will make it effective of our praying for ourselves is what? What will make the prayer effective there? Huh? What is it? Relationships have been what? Restored. But the moment relationships are broken down, that prayer can no longer be energio. Because James is saying that when we have sins committed amongst ourselves, okay, and broken down relationships, is implying that we will not be praying for one another. So the first thing we deal with, that means that if we are going to have a praying church, we must first of all have a church that works in love. Does that make sense? Huh? Does that make sense? So we deal first of all with forgiveness amongst ourselves. Then we can now have a corporately devoted church to prayer. So, if you are going to have, that means, if we are going to have a praying church, we must first of all have a church that works in love. So, James deals first and foremost with broken down relationships. Now, you know, Paul taught that as well about couples. You know, in 1 Corinthians 7, 5. And Peter said the same thing about couples. He said, that your prayers be not hindered. Of course, some people have said that it means that if you have fighting with your wife as you pray, God, you go and visit your wife. No. That your corporate prayers be not hindered. You're praying together. So some couples have a way of doing it. They back themselves. They are doing the opening prayer. So he says you will first restore. How many of you are seeing something unique about how James writes? Are you seeing it? He switches. And so I think that if you are going to put James in chapters, it will be up to 15 chapters. Who agrees with me? If you are going to conceptualize in chapters, you know, it just switches. It moves from you are tested for your faith to you are tempted to sin. And it's the same words he used. Are you getting this? It moves from you are born of God. Then he says, therefore be swift to your soul to speak. For the wrath of man. Then he now talks about doing the word. And he says, then he now starts by saying the perfect law of liberty. Then he now comes and talks about the law and the prophets. What a style. And I told you that is similar to how who teaches Jesus. He was in his brother's brother. I think I have to get away with that. You know. So he really had a style. So the effectiveness of that prayer, of course, don't forget that. That means James 5:16. Is James 5:16 talking about personal prayer or collective? Praying for, of course, it's still personal because it's still one person that will do the prayer for the other person. But it's talking about praying for others. So it becomes effective where there is forgiveness. Does it make sense? Who did you know taught prayer like that? Jesus. When you stand praying, forgive. Mark 11:25. It was Jesus that taught prayer like that. You forgive us our trespasses so that we forgive those who trespass against us. So, can we say that he's taking a cue from Jesus' teaching in the four Gospels? He is. So, it deals with physical healing, then it deals with the restoration of relationships in James. Now, he now uses Elijah. Again, tricky, because Jesus had a way. Jesus used Elijah primarily for John the Baptist and how Elijah ministered to the widow. But he says Elijah prayed. So, again, it's teaching us the wisdom of learning from the prophets of old. You know, he removed the wrath and just took the attitude. Job, patience, consistency, Superman, no, just staying under, not grumbling and complaining. So we learn from that. Then he mentions Elijah. Of everything, he said he prayed. Then he says he prayed again. So that means his energy is now twofold. One, we are able to, because there are restored relationships, we are praying for one another, and then we are praying consistently. And so this is Paul's praying always. Who's following what I'm saying here? Are you following what I'm saying here? We seem to be thinking that his focus was praying to get results. But no, his focus was continual praying. You can easily lose what he's saying. Continual praying. He says, look at Elijah. He now calls him a man of like passions. The word homoiopathes, H-O-M-O-I-O-P-A-T-E-S, or P-H-E-P-A-T-H-E-S, any word, you know. It means he has similar feelings and similar suffering. And Paul and Barnabas use that in Acts 14, 15. We are men of like passions, just like you. That we are, he's facing, and that word is used for temptation. That he's tested and tried just like everybody. Homoiopathes. He was a man of like passions. However, he says, as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain. And it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. So, what are we learning from Elijah? To pray about rain or to pray for one another consistently? Is it making sense here? Are you following this? To pray for one another again and again. So he uses that as an example of praying. Is that similar to Ephesians 6:18? Praying always. Who did Paul say to pray always for? One another. Praying for saints. But James, first of all, deals with our internal wranglings. He said, if there are any sins that have been committed, existing sins, that's not sin against God. Interpersonal relationships. Say, resolve it. What did Jesus say? He said, before you go to the temple, first of all, resolve with your brother. Your brother. So, it's key. Now, we can stretch this a bit further. When Jesus says that, look, whatever you ask, let's leave that. Because it will want to see where he gleaned from Jesus' words. So obviously, he says here, he breaks his words, number one, to physical healing, right? Then healing in relationships. But the point is that he uses similar words to teach different concepts. Is it making sense here? Now, by saying the prayer of a righteous man here is obviously the believer. Because he had told us earlier, Abraham, alright, Abraham believed God, it was accounted to him for righteousness. That's James 2, verse 23. So the prayer of that believer, that's why, by if you were talking about attitude, he would have said, pray for one another, brethren. So, the brethren he's talking to are definitely those who have been declared righteous. Is it making sense? Alright. So, let's go back to that hour. We left it. We all left it like that. The oath of verse 12. We'll just leave it alone. Does he stand on his own? Or is he still related to verse 11? Huh? You are, I like you are trying. I'm trying. Yes? When you are persecuted, yes. There's a tendency for you to swear. Okay, did somebody do that you know in scripture? That under persecution, it made a hole. Huh? Peter. What is it? Jephthah. That's far. Okay, explain how Jephthah made. Okay. He said, when Jephthah was raised up, but he made an oath that whatever comes out of it, I'll sacrifice. Persecution? That's battle. Just like Jacob said, if you preserve my life, I'll give you a tenth of all I have. This is persecution. It's different. Is it generally dealing with not making oath? You know, that's, our issue is not that. Is it related to persecution? James and the way he writes. Is that the issue, really? You know, Paul's writing is smooth. I'm joking. Huh? You think his own paragraph, on his own, he stands on his own. Yes and no to what? I don't want persecution, I want persecution. Yeah, just say yes or no, yes or no. I don't know what yes or no. Yes. Oh, is he saying pray instead of making an oath? Or don't make an oath at all? Under any condition, don't make an oath. Or just let it hang. Yes. The character of God. I want to know. Wow. He's saying that did Job make an oath? Job was like this. No. James stuck with Job's patience. So you are thinking under I don't get you again actually. I get you, but I think the character of God you brought in there was a bit tricky. Anybody? I think he should be left on his own. I think he's left on his own. There are things James said that should be left on their own. Because there is no point. Jesus said his own also on his own. On his own. Let your yes be yes. Obviously, he's saying, I guess from that I can agree with you that James obviously is saying, look, don't be double-minded. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. It can apply to anything. Prayer, persecution, everything. But it stands on its own generally as a Christian. You should not have to rely on something to make a statement. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. Don't be double-minded. Be single-minded. Or is it a doubt yes? Huh? Is it a doubt yes? You are not saying anything. Any contrary opinion? The paragraph ends in 11. 12. 12 is our issue. 12. Because above all things, it throws it away from 11. It seems to stand on its own. Then the question of 13 separates it. Is there any sick? You can't be saying, don't swear an oath. Is there any sick? They are not related. Above all things, takes that statement to stand on his own. Any reservation? Yes. Where? All things. Yeah. Above all things. Which things? Huh? What is it? You are finally asking. About your observation. Above all things, which things? Amidst all the persecution, let it just be yes, or generally as a believer. Because we have seen that he took words from Jesus' words. And Jesus' Matthew 5 stood on his own. Why can't James not stand on his own? Did James make statements like that are on their own? Did we have any two verses that stand on their own? The low brother rejoiced that he's exalted. The flower passes away. He stood on his own. Did he stand on his own? Be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to run. Did he stand on his own? Yeah. So why can't James 5:12 stand on his own? He can. And it is a general instruction for all believers. Okay? Maybe at that point I will take a clip on what you said. Was it here? That it dealing again with don't be double-minded. Okay. So let's now do the home run. This one is the one that requires a little bit of carefulness. I've been talking about prayer. I mean, he mentioned prayer a lot. So James taught prayer, praying for one another. Just like the epistles taught generally. Pray for one another, you know, deal with relationships, you know, resolve them. Then it says, brethren. Different paragraph? Huh? Is 19 different? If any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, is that one a believer? Be careful. And he converts him, which is the word epistrepho, used almost single-handedly for repentance towards the gospel. To turn back. Plana O have been used by the same James in James 1, 16. Do not err, my beloved brethren. So that makes you think that maybe he's talking about that. Well, that he's talking about individual conduct now. But notice, he says, let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. Is that evangelism or correcting believers in their conduct? Huh? So, why? So, your challenge is any of you. Can that any of you be a non-Christian? Why? I can say, brethren, if any man. So what death? Okay, I agree. Let's look. What death? Is the death there physical? No. Is the death spiritual? Or is that death related to James 1:15? Sin, when it is matured, will produce death. You say James has come again. Is that fellow a believer or a non-believer? Look at the word epistrepho, turn back. To turn back. Of course, by saying that you hide a multitude of sins. It's similar to what Peter also said. Love covers a multitude of sins. And they use the same word. Same word. James. Is this a believer or a non-believer? What a way to end this series. Is he a non-believer or a believer? Who thinks he's a non-believer? Oh, okay. Can the death there be figurative? Because by saying error of his way and using multitude of sins, that means you're not talking about a conduct. But again, our problem will be 1 Peter 4, verse 8. Love covers a multitude of sins. Is that the love of believers among themselves or the love of God? Okay, which love covers a multitude of sins? Is it me forgiving you for what you have done to me or what Christ has done? What is it? Yes. Is that love there specific in our conduct or God's love generally? Because if I say, the love of God is shed abroad in your heart by the Holy Ghost, and I say, God commends love to us while we are yet in us, Christ died for us. It's the same love I'm talking about. So, God's love that I walk in towards you is what covered most of those sins. So, James is saying, if I convert someone, assuming that, let's put a thing to present that the guy is an unbeliever, I convert him from the error of his way. Can the error of his way be unbelief or is not yet a believer? So I convert him and then I, by what I've done, I've saved his soul. Because he has said to us that our soul was saved in James 1:21. I've saved his soul from death and I have what? Hidden multitude of sins. Is that salvation or conduct? You know what you want to think. Who thinks it's tricky? Why? Yes. Yeah. But he dealt with unbelievers oppressing people. Oh, anyway, the rich generally, which had the unbeliever in mind as well. Unbelievers. Talking about, can't he conclude on evangelism? Go into all the world and preach the gospel, just like his brother. For the believer. But the sinner there is conduct, which is spelled out. This one talks about a multitude of sins. The error of his way is figurative. Wow. He thinks it's figurative. Who thinks so too? So the error of his way there is a conduct. So saving the soul from death, what will be the figurative death there? Oh, you don't agree with him. Okay, what do you agree with? Choose whom you will serve. Or are you double-minded? What will be the death there? We have to solve it though. Do you think he's talking to believers? Who thinks he's talking to believers? Huh? Okay, so if you think he's talking to believers, Doesn't the death there give you problems? Huh? Does the death there not be challenging? And shall I hide a multitude of sins? Okay, can we say that the error is referring to is still related to what he had mentioned in verse 16 and 15, sins among brethren? Because that's what Peter dealt with. Look at Proverbs 10:12, where Peter, and of course himself, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. So, would he be talking about hatred? The same hatred John called sin unto death. Can you remember? Are we there? Okay, it's believers and their attitude towards one another. Who agrees with that? So the death is liberating. So you save from death. Save from what death? Consequence or action? Is the death there consequence or action? Because you converted him from the error of his way. That means he had been walking like this. So you saved him from death. The death is the error of his way. Or is the death an eventual consequence? Action. So in other words, by correcting a believer who is not walking in love, is that what he's saying? You save him from what? Such an action. And then what do you do? 1 Peter 4:8 and Proverbs 10:12. You cover what? Okay, so lack of walking in love is called a multitude of sins. Okay, we are done.